Hey, everybody. Welcome to Mooncast. I'm Hector Real, along with Ben Wetzel.
Hey.
We are professional designers with over 20 years of experience, and we aim to help you with your creative endeavors. Today, we're going to be talking about a couple of things. We're going to be talking about the design solution process. What that means is that we're going to go through our design process, the kind of process that we may use when we are on a project from start to finish. And I'll go through every single phase of that, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So should be a really fun show.
Yeah.
Hey, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you do this weekend? Oh, yeah? Sounds exciting.
Did a show and played Call of Duty.
The new one?
The modern. Yeah.
Dude, my buddy is the, I want to say the director for that game.
Oh.
And he sent me the trailer, a bunch of friends of us. And I have to get a console now, because the last time I bought a console, and I play it on the console, sorry, hardcore gamers. I play console because I'm boring. I bought my last Xbox because of the very first Modern Warfare.
Sure.
Because he worked on that too.
Yeah.
And then he went off to a different company, and now he's back on this project with Infinity Ward.
Yeah.
And he is the director for this game, and it looks effing amazing.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. It's kind of reduces a lot of the weirdness that had been building up in the series, and kind of goes back to like the Modern Warfare thing where it started.
What do you play off of?
I'm just Xbox, but it's cross-platform. So
does that mean, like, tell me a little bit about that, because obviously I don't know much about gaming. So if you're in a PS, whatever it is now,
PS4. Yeah.
Apologies once again. And I'm on an Xbox. Can I be playing you in the same map?
Now.
Okay. So it wasn't like that before.
Yeah. No, this is the first Call of Duty to ever be cross-platform. So,
what?
Yeah. So it works. Instead of being like you logging in to your Xbox account.
Yeah.
I mean, you do log into your Xbox account, or you do log into your PlayStation 4 account, but you can, when you try to get into the game, it actually prefers that you use your Activision account.
Right.
And then that allows, basically, the game is always taking in people from anywhere.
Right.
So it's actually between all three. So PC, PlayStation 4, and Xbox are all on the same server.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it...
And so now I definitely have to, I've been talking to Ben about this for a long time, because I only play like a handful of games, and usually it's either a flight simulator or first person shooters like this. But this one, my friend directly worked on, and so I really want to buy it. And so now I have to buy an Xbox, and Ben knows right now I'm in the market for a new TV. And Ben has expensive tastes in TV.
I do.
Because I was expecting to spend like maybe $600-700. Ben was like $1,200, dude. I was like, what the hell, man?
Yeah.
He was like, because of the blacks and the colors. That's how he sounds like in my head.
Wow.
It's side lit. And whatever the fuck, dude. I don't know what any of this shit means.
Yep. You don't want it to be side lit.
Well, that's what she said. See, this is why we're not professionals, man.
I thought we were.
So, Ben recommends me to buy a couple, or recommend me a couple of options to buy. Yeah, and they're about the $1,200 mark, and I so don't want to pay $1,200 for one. And now I've got to get that and a console, because I've got like freaking original Xbox 360 or whatever.
Yeah. Well, just wait. At the end of the year, the new Xbox comes out. And
did you just say wait at the end of the year? Do you know what month it is right now?
Yeah, I know. It's going to be a while. But the thing
but
is...
But when that happens, when it's freaking November or December, oh, just wait until the end of next year.
No, I'm never going to
get one.
No, if you wait, you can buy the new Xbox, and then it's 100%. The rumor is it's going to be 100% backwards compatible with everything. So it'll play Xbox One, Xbox 360, and Xbox original games.
So you're saying to not enjoy myself for the rest of this year,
I mean,
just so I can have another platform that's backwards compatible.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's...
So miss out on like 3/4 of a year, basically what you're saying.
Actually, that's a good point. Now that I think about it, Modern Warfare will have run its course by November, because the next Call of Duty will be out by then.
So you're dead, essentially, that was bullshit.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You should, if you want to play the one that your friend made now, you should buy it now, because the next one is being made by, I think, Treyarch. Or no, okay. It's the third company, and theirs will be out this year.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is Ben Wetzel, also my project manager, who manages all of my projects. Thank you very much for giving me shitty information.
That's right.
Okay, well, I guess I'm gonna have to, you know what we can do is when we get that TV, or depending on what TV I get, we could probably kind of break down the design aspects of it. That should be really fun.
Yeah, for sure.
I definitely have to get that console. So no, Ben, I don't think I get your $1,200 TV. Ben's gonna be like, can I spend that at your house?
Gonna have to go for the UHD quality or exactly. Whatever.
All right, so that's awesome. Let's go ahead and roll into the design aspect of our show, really the meat of our show. It's basically the design process, and this is generalized, but it's a design process that we use to start our projects and end our projects with the deliverables.
Yeah, we've talked about the beginning of the design process before, but now we're going to go into a little bit more into depth, and B, we're actually going to cover a lot of what we do in terms of our workflows.
Right.
So we're going to give you guys a little bit more details in general.
So just to kind of recap on what we do, if you haven't downloaded the other episodes, but you should, we are actually a design consultancy. We are based out of Hollywood, California, and we design vehicles, transportation design, product design, all encapsulated within the industry of industrial design. Wow, that didn't sound great. The industry of industrial design. Designception is what that is. So here's a process of, let's just say you're working for a client. Even if you're a freelancer, this could help you out.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a lot of information here, but this is the process that we go through as a consultancy. Again, similar formula if you are a freelancer and you're working on a much larger project, because sometimes they will hire a freelancer to run their internal design company, depending on your experience, right?
Or like work on the team, the design team.
Exactly.
Because they don't have enough people on it.
Right. Or you could have a particular expertise that they need
right.
that they don't have on the team.
Yeah. And you have to like work with the other people to get something done.
Right. So one thing that I say a lot as a professional designer is this phrase, design must be above all else a solution. And really what that means is that when a designer comes up with a design, it should be solving a problem at all times. It should make somebody's life easier. It should be a solution. Aesthetics is great. If a design looks brilliant, but it doesn't help anyone, then it's kind of useless, right?
Sure.
So design must be, above all else, a solution. Basically, it makes your design kind of more complete. You're helping somebody out and it looks beautiful and it's probably going to sell more of it if you're designing a product.
Yeah.
So the first part of the design process is obviously research. And essentially when a client comes to you, he's presenting you a problem that he has, whether or not that's, hey, we need a shock absorption design solution for this iPhone so it doesn't break, or Android so it doesn't break, but it needs to be within this price point, or it needs to be made out of this material. He's going to come to you with a problem. Your job as a designer is to solve that problem. And to start that, you're going to have to do a ton of research. And you know, you ask yourself questions like, who am I designing this for? Who's buying it? What problem or problems do they have, and how can I solve that? How do I make this? With what materials will I make this with? How do I make this as elegant as possible? If that's the aesthetic you're looking for, you know, is it feasible for manufacturing? Now, this part is really important to clients. Any designer, professional designer, is good enough to make a beautiful looking design. It takes real skill to develop a beautiful looking design that's manufacturable.
Oh yeah.
You know, and Ben, you've come across this a lot, haven't you?
Oh yeah. Manufacturing, it's not magic.
Right.
And you can be really great at making things, but when it comes down to it, it's like, can this actually be injection molded, or can it be milled or lathed or whatever?
And right.
If the weirder it looks or the cooler it looks sometimes, the more likely it's like, ooh, yeah, no,
right.
This can't be made.
So with that research, familiarize yourself with the manufacturing process. And I'm not saying all designs need to be manufactured. Like obviously, graphic design, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be manufactured. Some of them do, you know, if you're doing signage or whatever. But no matter what project you're working on, just be familiar with how the production process works.
Right.
Because that helps you become a better designer. Because now you're not only designing for the client, you're not only designing for yourself, but you're also designing for the people making that product. And that's really important.
It really is.
You know, because a production time, if you're going for deadlines, production time can be missed if you don't design for manufacturing. And what is that called, Ben?
You talking about the deadline?
The DFM.
Oh, yeah.
The DFM, when manufacturers say DFM, DFM stands for design for manufacturer, meaning that whatever design you give to the factory, it should be designed with you knowing how it will be created. They'll work on other things, the other technical aspects, how tooling works and all that stuff, but you should know that whether or not a design could be made into a mold, can it be pulled from a mold? Will it need sliders? Does it need to be CNC machined? You know, what kind of plastics to use? Are you going to use recycled plastics or virgin plastics? All that stuff. You know, and if you're not a professional yet, it's really, really good. It sounds really boring right now, but honestly, if you like design and you figure out what all these materials do, it's kind of fun to learn about.
And there's a lot of engineering that goes in design.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really helpful to at least have an idea of some of these things.
Right.
Again, we keep talking about versatility, but like, I mean, if you don't know what certain plastics are capable of doing, it could end up making your life more difficult in the future. And I'm not saying you need to be a chemical engineer or anything, but
right.
Like you should know that, you know, like, I don't know, polyurethane is like a staple, and like,
yeah.
What does it do? What can it be used for? Stuff like that.
What does poly mean? And what does urethane mean? It's like real, it's honestly real simple stuff like that, because you move words around and add other words, it's a completely different material.
Right.
You know, polyethylene, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
I just remembered something. If you're listening to this and you're a designer and you've never heard of this show, I would suggest you go to YouTube and search a little show called How It's Made. You know, it's honestly, the narration and the music is, I mean, it was outdated when it came out.
Sure.
It's very outdated, but informatively, it's really interesting.
It is. You learn about so much of what you're like eating, what you're using on a daily basis, and
right.
You get to see like what it actually takes to make something.
It's basically a show that takes the camera from the first part of manufacturing at a factory, whether that's literally they've done episodes on hang gliding, on helicopters,
yeah.
On food, how they manufacture sandwiches.
Yeah.
Did you know that sandwiches are manufactured?
Yeah, I've seen
they are.
I've seen cereal. I saw a cereal episode where they're like, you know, making French Toast Crunch or something like
right.
That. Or Cinnamon Toast Crunch or whatever.
French Toast Crunch.
They came out with French Toast Crunch. You don't remember
no,
that?
I don't remember that.
It's so good.
Is it French Toast Crunch or French Kiss Crunch?
It's little loaves of bread that look like they're French toast. That was so good.
You're a lying liar who lies. Is that, are you serious?
I'm dead fucking serious right now. I'm not dude, kidding.
I don't know if I have to search that.
You, I don't know if it's available anymore.
Oh, really? How convenient.
How convenient.
Oh, I don't know. It's just, I don't know.
I think we're only back wrong. To cinnamon now.
It's just like that girlfriend that you've never met. You know, she's in Canada. She's in Canada.
Yeah, she's far away. She's far away.
So the show is called How It's Made, and I've seen a couple episodes on YouTube. I used to watch it when it was on the Discovery Channel, when Discovery Channel used to be informative.
Right.
But now it's on YouTube, and it's really, really, really informative. So definitely search that. It'll help you out a lot of knowing how the manufacturing process happens.
It's invaluable.
Right. All right. So let's get into, or rather, let's move from research to ideation and sketching. Now, this is probably the most fun part about being a designer is you start sketching stuff and you start putting ideas together.
Sure.
There's in my design school, the way that we were taught is that we would basically have an 11 by 17 sheet of paper and we would do thumbnail drawings. Essentially, they're just sketches that are like an inch by an inch or an inch by 2 inch in size. And we would do essentially wallpapering. We would fill up the entire page of just hundreds of sketches and just pump these ideas out, even if it's shitty ideas or even if it's ideas that you know would never get manufactured, but you just plop it all down on paper. It's basically visual brainstorming, right? And then you go back later on and pick off the designs that you think might work. And the next phase of that is, you know, making slightly larger sketches, maybe like a 5-inch by 5-inch sketch while you're working out these ideas. And ideation and sketching, it's exactly that. You're coming up with ideas and you're doing it through sketching. And once you come up with something that you might go through in terms of like the direction that you want to take the project, then you get into more and more detail of sketching, like, what features does it have? What parts does it have? But most importantly, going back to what we said earlier, always think of how this is going to be manufactured if you're designing a product.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And sketching is important. And knowing that when you design a product, you DFM it, essentially, design it for manufacturing. Once you get further into the design process, that's going to get easier and easier and easier because it's really difficult to design something really nice and then you have to go back and figure out how to manufacture it.
Yeah, that can cause a lot of changes.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, that's not the end all.
No.
No, that in some projects, yeah, it's great to do that first and come back and see if you could DFM it. But generally speaking, for most projects, especially for simple projects, if you know enough, you can design for manufacturing while you're sketching.
Yeah. Sometimes clients just want to see crazy stuff first, you know?
Right.
And then there's like a work down period or scaling down period where you start to like bring this sort of extravagant design more into reality. Like, okay, this is an overhang. There's no way this can be cammed. Therefore, it can't be manufactured. So we have to bring it in a little bit,
right?
Reduce it down, stuff like that. And sometimes people want to do that because they just want to get kind of like they want to go big first and then come down to a more grounded area. But again, that's not always the case.
Right. There's a saying from Art Center that they used to give to us when we were students is the instructors basically say, I'd rather have you design things where I'll have to pull you back than have you design things where I have to push you forward.
Yes. Yeah. I think while we're talking about the importance of design for manufacturing, and it is super important, that's hitting the nail on the head for sure. You shouldn't nerf your design quality to meet something that you're not 100% on yet. I mean, right. It's the same thing with acting in video games. It's best to go all the way and come back than it is to like, right, scoot yourself up to the line.
Exactly. And the next step after ideation and sketching is going to be functionality design. And this is another take on DFM, right? Functionality design is when a product has a very particular function. Let's just say, a printer. Wow, I said printer. Printers aren't even really a thing anymore, are they?
They're pretty, yeah. I mean, brothers.
But not, you remember when years back when everybody had a printer?
Yeah.
Now people are calling me because I'm one of like four people with a printer.
Well, everybody realized they're a scam.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, let's just say, headsets, earphones.
Yeah.
They have a very specific function and need to function.
Absolutely.
So that has to be put into your design. So what features does it have? And just looking at my AirPods here is just like, yeah, I've got the AirPods, but a function is built into it, which is the case that charges it while it's in the case. That is a function.
Absolutely.
You know, another function in automotive design is on my car, I have a rear spoiler. When I'm on the street going at normal speeds, the spoiler is down. Now, when I go on the highway at 70 miles per hour plus, the spoiler automatically pops up. That is a function that's designed into the car. It's doing something really specific. So after you figure out what your general design is going to be, you're going to have to figure out what its functionality is. It could be, hey, I really want a really, really thin iPhone case, but I also want it to be able to survive a drop from 16 feet. That is also a function. So at this phase is when you figure all that stuff out. Again, design for manufacturer. Don't ever forget that. Sometimes you could let go so you could push yourself forward a little bit, but at some point, just remember that this is going to be manufactured.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that is for design functionality. The next phase is going to be CMF. And what does CMF stand for, Ben?
Color, material, and finish.
Exactly. So this is where it's kind of fun because materials and finish could do a lot for design.
Oh, yeah.
You know, depending on what target market you're trying to hit, materials, finish, and colors can send a message to the buyer one way or the other.
I mean, can you imagine a world where it was Apple Black instead of Apple White? I mean, it'd be a completely different style of branding.
Right.
You know exactly. What I mean?
And, you know, just imagine this is before Apple came out and, you know, not to push Apple too hard, but I do like Apple, truth be told.
They do a good job.
Yeah, they do a good job. But before Apple came out, I don't, some of you may not be this old. But a lot of the PCs and the computers were all beige.
Oh God, I know. Right? I grew up with an Apple computer in my house, and that thing was unpleasant to look at.
Yeah, an Apple computer?
Yeah, yeah. My dad.
Oh, the very first Macs.
Yeah, we're talking like early 90s, yeah. 80s.
It wasn't until the iMac?
Those rainbow ones.
Yeah. Until then that people were like, holy shit.
We should make these look like something.
Yeah, but you know what? I think nobody at that time, people were really afraid of just breaking apart from the norm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Apple took that risk.
Yeah.
Apple was like, well, hell, you know, and, you know, bright colors are not easy to sell to the public.
Sure.
This is a fact, and this is a fact that is supported by a lot of Nielsen research documentation. And if you don't know, Nielsen is a really, really huge marketing research company. The phrase that Nielsen says, rather that Nielsen supports that every salesman says is, no matter what product, black will sell.
Yeah.
Everybody loves the colored product. Everybody thinks, oh, hey, that's cool. That's interesting. But everybody buys the black colored product, black colored version of that product.
Yeah, for sure. Smudges don't show up.
Exactly. Now, for Apple to come up with these bright colors, it turned everything around.
Yeah, tangerine, lime, yeah. Like hot neon grape.
Right.
And then there was like
that turquoise one.
Yeah, the turquoise one and like a strawberry cherry-ish red. It was crazy.
Yeah, now it did its job, obviously. We're now more open-minded after that in terms of electronic.
Yeah.
Right. And then finishing.
Well, in that 90s era, Nintendo 64 came out with like all the different colored controllers too.
Right.
And you could buy like different colored 64s even.
Right.
So it was just kind of like everybody started kind of doing different colors and more stuff like that.
Yeah. And it's acceptable now, and which is a really great time to be a designer, because all these things are all acceptable and you don't have to take the risk for it because Apple already has.
Right.
In terms of like colors and stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
So there's that. That is, and I'm going to keep going here because there's a lot of chapters to cover, not chapters, but a lot of sections to cover. That is the importance of color, material, and finish. Next after that is final design solutions. And essentially, that's the phase where you've done your research, your ideation, your functionality design, your CMF, and now you're starting to refine your designs. And basically, you come up with a couple of directions. Those directions is generally you'll have 3 to 5. Generally, you'll have 3, but I like to give clients 3 to 5 because they prefer that. So the final design solutions is essentially the directions that you'll show to your client to see which direction they want to go. It could be a variation of your final design. It could be different colors. It could be different functionality. It could be different mechanisms. It doesn't have to be completely different designs, although that's in some cases, that's what they want.
Sure.
Essentially, you're going to say to the customer and say this, here are the best 3 to 5 solutions that I recommend for your problem. Which direction would you like to go?
And at this point, you're giving the client or your design director something very polished, right? Like you would want it to be rendered like either in Photoshop or an actual 3D render of something simply made.
Right. It's not the final render, but it's basically pretty close. You kind of want to get to about 85%.
Like presentation ready.
Yeah, right. Presentable.
Yeah.
And the only people who are going to be able to tell the difference between this and the absolute final render are usually designers and engineers. Usually the executives, sometimes they have designer backgrounds, but most of the time they don't, that they won't be able to tell the difference.
Sure.
But you kind of want this phase of the design process to make them feel like, holy shit, this is a great solution. And you've got one more phase where it's going to get even better.
Sure.
That's a very Hector way of selling shit, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So I only say that because Ben's seen me in presentations, and I like to have a little Easter egg in terms of my presentations, just because it's more fun for me to deliver. But we'll get into that in another episode about how I present design solutions, design ideas to executives.
Yeah, for sure.
So after your final design solutions, your 3 to 5, a client's going to pick one, unless they say they want one or more, but generally they'll pick one of that direction. And then you'll go into final full-on rendering. And it's usually multiple views, 3/4 front, 3/4 back, maybe a plan view, and maybe a feature view. Like this is exactly how it's going to look like. This is the actual design intent.
Right.
That's the super polished stuff. And if you're good at rendering in Photoshop, this is when you do it.
Yeah.
And you present that for approval for the client. And when they approve that, you go straight into 3D development. 3D development is when you go to your 3D programs and start building things for DFM. We've been talking about this the entire time. Once you get into 3D, 3D is basically your mechanical engineering at this point. You're just starting off mechanical engineering. You're figuring out how tooling is going to be made. You're going to figure out how mechanisms work, what parts are in that mechanism, and even sometimes, actually a lot of times, how much this is all going to cost, which is what's really, really important to your client. So when you get to 3D, make sure that you've got all this taken care of. And if you've been doing DFM from start to finish, this particular section of the project shouldn't be all that difficult or shouldn't take as much time. because you've already worked out all the mechanical engineering. And if you're not a mechanical engineer yourself, the client might have a mechanical engineer already in their staff, or you can consult a mechanical engineer and just add that into your budget for the client. So after 3D, the next phase is going to be rapid prototyping, which is something that Ben knows a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when you go into 3D, you go into rapid prototyping and you want to have a physical sample of the product in hand just so it functions exactly the way that you intended it to be. And surprise, surprise, it usually won't work the first time.
Yeah.
So Ben knows a lot about it because Ben used to run a lot of the prototyping machines.
Yeah.
What are some of the things about clients' designs that irk you after you've started printing things?
With 3D printing, you can get away with a lot more than you can with manufacturing. So that can often become a problem that you have to convey to your client or customer that, hey, the way you've built this, I can make it for you now, but I can't make it for you later. The other thing that happens a lot is you actually have to adjust your 3D model specifically for manufacturing in a prototype environment. A lot of times you have to make walls, you know, 2 to 3 times thicker than the final product would be because you're using prototype plastics. So they're way more brittle than like polyurethane or any of those other plastics out there. So you have to keep that in mind. Sometimes you haven't had enough time to work with a mechanical engineer. So you yourself have to come up with simple mechanisms that'll allow it to open or allow a fastener to be screwed in, stuff like that. These are all things that you kind of need to do and be able to do on the fly because, and you should also be good at explaining why it is you're doing these things, especially if it's not for you, you know, you're doing this for someone else. They're going to want to understand why it is you're doing what you're doing and how your prototype, while it is functioning now, needs to have changes done to it in the future. So those are problems I've run into for sure.
Yeah. And that's something to consider because after this phase, what you're going to do is you're going to take this prototype that you've had done. Let's say you've worked out all the kinks and all the bugs. You've got a prototype that's functioning generally how you want it to function. What you'll do after that is you'll send a 3D file and the prototype, preferably, to the factory wherever you're going to get it manufactured from, whether it's domestically or you want to get it manufactured overseas. And that goes straight to the factory. The factory will then evaluate the design. And then they'll ask you how many units you want made of this product. And from that, they will give you a quote. Now, this is now moving away from the design aspect, more into the project management aspect and the budgeting and pricing part of design. You know, I know a lot of the guys out there, they're designers and they like working on design and they don't usually work on costing and things like that. This is the kind of stuff that you'll have to work on once you go from being a junior designer, a mid-level designer, a senior designer, and you're kind of like in the design director part of the business. When you become a design director or a design manager, these are the kind of things that you'll have to worry about. And it's not just design, it's also how to manufacture these things. So this is kind of the part of the business that we're going to be going into moving forward from this conversation. So after you've sent the file and the 3D prototype to the factory, they'll give you a quote. When they give you this quote, it's usually going to include how much tooling is going to cost. Tooling is the steel mold where they inject plastic into that the machines will use to create your product. What labor is going to cost, and basically shipping and everything else is all going to be included in this quote. And you're going to get a pretty big number. And this is something that you'll have to present to your client saying, hey, look, the factory's quoting us this much. Is that okay with you? Is that not okay with you? Sometimes, as a design director, the client will say, hey, that's too expensive. Go back to the factory and deal with them and see if you get at a lower rate. Sometimes they'll do that for you. Sometimes you'll have to do that yourself.
Right.
So, you know, not the most sexy part of design, but it is something that someone has to handle. If no one else handles it, it's going to have to be you.
Yeah.
You know, and knowing all this, even if you're a freelancer, knowing all this is going to be really impressive to any client. So once you get that, you're going to go, let's just say that you get the quote, it gets approved by the client, and you know, you're good to go. The client has greenlit the project. What's going to happen is that the factory will go into tooling development. In our office and many other offices, that's called phase T1, Tango 1. Essentially means that's the first sample to come off the tooling one. And essentially what they'll do is they'll use an EDM machine, which is electromagnetic. Yeah, I totally messed that up. Electro displacement something.
Electrical discharge machining.
There you go. See? Electronic dance machining. Is that a fact? So, yes, it's called EDM. God, I can't pronounce it. It's called EDM.
Electrical discharge machining.
Electrical discharge machining. So this machine basically creates tooling, and it does so in a really, really clean fashion. And what they'll do is they'll take the first version of this tooling, put it into the machine, and give you a sample straight up from this first part of the tooling. And it's called an off-tool sample, essentially saying, here's our first shot of your design. Is it exactly what you want? And it's going to come back to you. And if you're doing it overseas, it's going to be mailed to you. You look at it and see if it, and evaluate it and see if that is exactly what your design intent is. And if you approve it, you basically send it back to the factory and say, A, this is really good. B, this is not good at all. Or C, this is pretty close, but we need to make some changes. After tooling one, generally what happens is that you're going to want to make some changes. I think this happens like 90% of the time.
Yeah.
So you're going to send it back to the factory and say, hey, this is great, but I need these changed, or I need these parameters changed, or I need this dimension changed. And they'll do another revision of that tool. Generally, what happens if they need to add material, they'll weld more steel on it and recarve it, or they'll carve whatever the tooling is and make it larger if that's what you're looking for. Again, this is all, it's all really difficult to explain through podcasts, but if you watch how it's made, it's going to make a lot more sense.
Yeah.
So after they've done the revision for the tooling, they're going to send you another sample, which is your second tool and your second tool sample. That is your T2, Tooling 2, Tango 2. So usually at around T2, if you're good, you could get it right during your second modification. And generally, it's all good to go. Now, if it comes back to you and you approve it and say, hey, this is really good, let's go for full production manufacturing, the factory will then create your entire design, all coming out of the tool, basically saying, this is exactly how you wanted it designed. Here's what the 3D file says. Here is how it's going to function. And here is the actual physical product. It may not be painted just yet, but it's basically all the parts coming out of that tooling in plastic form. And a lot of times it's going to have the electronics, if you have electronics in there, and you're going to get essentially what's referred to in the industry as the golden sample. What the golden sample means is that this is exactly what you're going to get at the very end of the manufacturing process. Are you okay with that? So if you are okay, if you do get the golden sample, essentially it's the fully refined product and you're okay with that, what you'll do is you'll actually, the factory will have you physically sign that sample on the plastic with your signature. And that basically states to yourself and the factory that you approved this and we are going to go for mass manufacturing. And that's important because sometimes mass manufacturing can go up to hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So once that's approved, they're going to go straight up into mass manufacturing. And essentially, a lot of things stop right there. And a lot of designers say, okay, well, my job's done. But what I like to do, and again, this is more of a design director responsibility, is that you stay with a project and you go for another phase. You wait until QC. QC stands for quality control. What that is that every batch, every so often, you ask the factory to pull a sample from that batch and send it to you so you can reevaluate to see if they're staying consistent.
Yeah, because sometimes they're not. Like pens that stab you when they shouldn't be stabbing you.
So we had that story. Let me get into that story a little bit. We had this carbon fiber pen manufactured overseas, and it's a really good looking pen. It's really nice.
It's
high
dope.
Quality.
Yeah.
I like this pen a lot. And if you guys follow my Instagram at I am Hector Real, that's IAMHECTORREAL, you'll find some of my posts with this pen in it. It's really, really cool. We sold it at the OC Auto Show and at the LA Auto Show, and it did really, really well. But there's some parts where we should have QC'd a bit more, and it seems like we missed a few where some of the metals were not filed, and they were really, really sharp.
Yeah.
Like
poketacular.
is that what it's called?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you were just to just write with it wrong or graze your skin wrong, it's gonna cut your skin. And so that's the kind of stuff you're looking for in QC. You know, does the mechanism work as smooth as you like it to be?
Yeah. I mean, it could be as something as, you know, it's just like a clamshell piece of equipment that's opening. And right. Is the tolerance on most of the product good enough that it closes shut and stays shut? Because sometimes it just fucking won't.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, nothing's going to be perfect, but you know, if one of those is having that problem, that's okay. But you know, if 15 of them did and you ordered 100 of them, then yeah. It's like, oh, well, that's kind of lame. You guys weren't checking this for me. You know, we need to figure out what to do because this is a problem.
You touched on something, Ben, that isn't on our script here, but I wanted to get into what you just said a few minutes ago,
sure.
A few seconds ago. So when you have 100 units and 15 of those units are bad, that's called a drop rate. What that means is that 15 did not pass. So that means it's a 15% drop rate for those 100% units. The factory is obligated to give you those 15 additional ones because that's what you ordered. But now, if you scale that up and say you're manufacturing, you know, 1,000 or 10,000, then it would still be that drop rate where you have to make sure that drop rate stays low because you don't want a lot of defects.
No, you don't. Because, I mean, if you're, you know, trying to use good business ethics, you right. shouldn't sell the bunk ones.
Right. Because that's bad for your company. That's bad for your reputation. It's bad for a lot of things.
Yeah.
And it's also bad for the factory. So the factory, it's in their best interest to make sure they get things right.
Yeah, for sure.
This other part is actually also not on our list here, but after QC is a phase called QA. What that is that you kind of keep an eye on the products. And you basically test it for longevity. When will it break? How will it break? And hopefully, and you can't plan for that 100%. You don't know how people will use it. You have a good idea, but people abuse things more than others. And what QA does is that when people return things to the company, you evaluate those returns and see what broke. And then you make changes in production for future orders.
Yeah.
So the QA aspect of it. Now, the final part of this whole design process, and I know we're talking about a lot of information here, but it's, you know, like I said before, it's really good information to know.
Yeah. We got one more. Just one more.
Just one more. Bear with us a little bit because I really think this is important. After QC, you'll have to go through shipping. Now, this is probably the most unsexy part of designing things. You've got to go through shipping, and shipping includes two versions. There is shipping by ocean and shipping by air. You can either do those or do a combination of those. And again, this will be good information for you to have because you can then provide this information to the client if you get caught in certain situations that we'll talk about in a few seconds here. So first thing, the cheapest way to ship is through ocean. Basically, what happens is the factory will put it all in boxes and pallets, and they'll take your shipment and they'll drive it off to a port, either Shanghai or Hong Kong, and they will put it on a ship and send it to a port wherever you are. For us, it's going to be Los Angeles, or it could be San Francisco, and it's got to go through customs and all that stuff. Shipping time is about 28 days, about 3 weeks at the fastest, you know. And you also have to account for, it might take a couple of days to clear customs once it gets to the United States, if that's where you are, or if you're in the UK or whatever. It's got to go through customs.
Yeah.
And if your factory does it correctly, it should go to customs easily if they are a reputable factory. Sometimes you might get tricked by non-reputable factories and you will have trouble. Just make sure that you evaluate the factories before you even start doing business with them. But let's just say it is a very reputable factory. It goes through customs just fine. 28 days. Good thing about that is it's usually 70-75% cheaper to ship your product by ocean because it takes so damn long. So it's a lot cheaper. If you're buying massive amounts, like, you know, pallets and pallets of product, whatever that is, it's cheaper to ship by boat. And if it's heavy, so much cheaper to ship by boat. It just takes a little while to get here. But some situations doesn't give you the luxury of time. So what you'll have to do is that you may opt to ship your products from the factory to your port or to your store or wherever you're sending the products to your warehouse by air, which is much more expensive. The rule of thumb is air is generally 4 to 6 times more expensive than shipping by ocean. For a product that we developed a couple months, or rather last year, shipping by ocean was, I think, like 18 cents per product on top of the product cost. So the product cost $1, shipping by boat was like 18 cents. And, you know, that's not a lot. Obviously, multiply that by however many units, 2,000, 5,000 units that you order adds up.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and I think shipping by air was like $1 and something.
Dang.
You know, it's at least 4 to 6 times more. But shipping by air is really convenient because you can get product shipped to wherever your warehouse is in about 4 days all over the world. Now, here's the thing with air shipping with DHL, FedEx, and a few of Cargolux, a few other cargo companies, they have their own customs department at their airport hub. It doesn't have to go to another customs building. They have it there and it's processed while you're in the air. So basically, DHL, FedEx, UPS, all those guys process customs so fast that it can get to you in 4 days, sometimes 6, sometimes 7 days, but still better than 28 days.
Right.
So do think about that if you're thinking about shipping or the logistics part of it. Here's the third scenario is sometimes your client will say, hey, that's a lot of money because we ordered 50,000 of these units or whatever. That's a lot of money to be shipping by air, but we're going to launch the product in a week and a half. So we need it here like immediately. In this situation, and what I've done is that I would ship most of the inventory by ocean. And I would ship about 4 weeks worth of inventory by air. So yes, it's going to be a bit more expensive, but we get the product for the launch. And the launch is important because it goes through marketing and it goes through telling the public about the product and the brand. So that's really important. But you have a month's worth of inventory. So as you run out of the inventory in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, then the ocean inventory arrives and hopefully you're good to go. So that's a lot of information, I know, and I'm sorry, but I hope you got something out of it. It is basically the entire process in a very generalized form of how to start from design to manufacturing to shipping, logistics, and basically you can use that information to help out your client, and that will make you look a lot better as a professional than just, hey, I just design things. You know?
Yeah, it will. It will help if you know a little bit about it.
Yeah. So, you know, I really do hope that helped you out. And if there's any part of that section that you want us to kind of elaborate on, to go more into detail, we will. Just let us know. Ask us, contact us through our website, that is maroonvaultstudio.com, or you can add me on Instagram at I am Hector Real. That is the letter I, the letter A, the letter M, Hector Real on Instagram. And if you've got a question you want to ask me, just go ahead and DM me there. And if I can answer it in a sentence or two, I'll definitely answer you right back. But if it takes a little bit more time to answer your question, and as we did with Vivian during her question, we'll address it on our next podcast episode. Also, I think if you downloaded the last episode, Ben and I talked about power drinks, or what is it, energy drinks?
Energy drinks.
We're going to incorporate that somehow in our podcast because, you know, we're into energy drinks, but I'm going to do a taste test just because it's fun.
Oh, yeah.
So this is me. I am Hector Real, and this is Ben Wetzel.
That's me.
We are signing off, and we will see you again in the next episode.
Yep. Have a good one.